Hi, and welcome to another edition of Editing Aloud, and how lovely it is to be back again amongst friends. And Warren, this morning, Peter Moyo was back at Old Mutual, but wasn't allowed past reception.
Correct. It was his third time, yeah. Peter. And he got the same line. The company gave the same line that he was neither requested nor needed to appear before work. And it seems that the dispute seems to center around the second letter of termination that Old Mutual gave him, which the company maintains is legally valid and was done correctly, whereas his lawyers are saying that that they had just gone to court on Monday to have that second letter attached to the dispute around the first letter, yeah. Which the judge ruled was unfair on procedural grounds. They're saying that the second letter and the first letter, there's no distinction between the two, because the second letter actually referenced the first letter. So it's all getting a little bit technical there, but the net result is that he has not been able to return to work.
It's getting technical, but also ridiculous. I mean, this is a major South African financial institution being drawn into what looks like a circus.
Absolutely.
Is it affecting the share price? Is it?
Absolutely, it has been affecting the share price. I think the last time we checked, it was about 10 billion rand. 10 billion rand had been taken
because
off
because of this.
It's hard to pinpoint that in the market, but certainly when investors wake up and they see this dispute on the front pages of the Business Day, it's very unsettling for an organization and certainly for staff morale when they see this.
And just lastly, who are the big institutional shareholders in Old Mutual?
If I remember correctly, I think the PIC is in there, but you've got a couple of the large private sector. I think Alan Gray is a large shareholder. Yeah. Some of them have been using the opportunities to buy up shares given the weakness, because they think over a long term this will be a hiccup in the fortunes of the company. But even today, the share price was down about 1.5%.
So, Kanata, you've been sort of central to this story. I mean, you were at the famous press conference, which I have to say I watched with horror, because you could see Trevor Manuel getting more and more irritated as he went along. And anybody who's known Trevor would know that he's got a very short fuse. And he made the remark that he did about the judge. You've since written that you think he ought to resign.
Yes, absolutely, Peter. Look, there's no benefit in having Trevor Manuel there now. That short fuse that you're talking about, all the blunders we are seeing with regards to Peter Moyo are as a result of that emotional and the short fuse. So that's the start. But he has to resign also, because he should never have been allowed onto that board in the first place. I don't know what the strategy is.
But he wouldn't have hid anything from the board. I mean, they knew that he was with Rothschilds, which is a...
There's certainly no accusation of him acting improperly. Yeah. Absolutely none. Nobody has, and neither have I. He's always, at all material times, recused himself where Rothschild's business is concerned. Yeah. But the perception of the chairman being on both sides of the deal is, in this instance, and particularly when matters get this ugly, is totally undesirable. So from that basis alone, Trevor Manuel should not be on the board. And secondly, he is the chairman of the board that has totally mishandled this situation.
Can I just ask you that?
And the heads have to roll.
South Africa, it's common in South Africa to have board members who sit on lots of other boards. So there have to be dozens of conflicts, of potential conflicts of interest because of cross-board
directorships.
TJ, and maybe you'll all know the answer to this, but just to remind people how this arose, Peter Moyo owned a company or started a company that Old Mutual invested in, and which then, if you just help me here, it then made a decision which Old Mutual took exception to.
Yes, so that decision... Old Mutual says that there are a few things that irked them, but the big one recently was when Moyo chaired a board meeting of NMT Capital.
Right.
This is the company
that he
at stake.
Yeah.
Yes, and I mean, there's a sort of a funny timeline. He worked at Old Mutual in the late 90s. Yeah. Old Mutual started this company in the early 2000s. Yeah. Old Mutual invested quite early on, and then he rejoined Old Mutual a few years ago.
Yeah, and it was well known that he was that this company was there, and they had that relationship.
It's
right?
flagged, and they, I mean, they had a special committee that looked at this. So he chaired a board meeting of NMT, and at the board meeting, there were dividends declared to ordinary shareholders. Yeah. Old Mutual being an ordinary shareholder, yes.
Yeah.
And then the directors themselves.
And there was an Old Mutual represent, and this is, and there was no Mutual director on the board, right? Who voted for this?
So the, this is the thing we can't see from the minutes what exactly happened there.
Oh, really?
But there is an Old Mutual official was on the board, and this is one of the things that Manuel at that press conference stressed over and over again is. The fiduciary duty of the director is to the company he is then the director of. So it's not as if he then reports into a line going back to Old Mutual and representing Old Mutual's interests.
Do we buy
this? This
is the official line.
He is actually, that's the problem here. So that related parties committee on of the board does not have itself a representative on the board of NMT Capital. They had a former employee of Old Mutual, nominated by Old Mutual to serve.
Is he no longer with Old Mutual?
He's no longer with Old Mutual, but when he was still at Old Mutual, in the short period that Peter Moyo had joined Old Mutual, the guy reported to Peter Moyo at Old Mutual and was supposed to be supervising him at NMT Capital.
But so we don't know whether he put his hand up for the dividend payout.
That's what
the minutes, according the minutes, are silent on his participation on that particular decision.
Yeah.
And the issue here is that that ordinary dividend was declared ahead of the preference share dividend, which contravenes the Companies Act. Mm. And had that been done before, Old Mutual would have been first in line to claim its share. So they subsequently reversed it or facilitated the payment of the preference share dividend. But
do we have a view, aside from the ethics and the cross interests and the potential conflicts of interest, do we have a view who is legally right here? I mean, is the Old Mutual board legally right?
It's not that simple, Peter. Mm. There are two things here. Mm. How do you fire an employee you no longer want? And is a chief executive, can he be treated like an ordinary employee in terms of the Labor Relations Act? So that's what the court has had to deal with. And Peter Moyo so far has won on that basis, saying...
And is this all happening in the Labor Court?
Unfair, yes.
Okay.
Is it the High Court or the Labor
Court? No, it's the High Court. And this is the interesting thing. Moyo and his lawyers, they didn't want the Labor Relations Act involved there. They were going on the on that very specific special contract that that the chief executives have. I mean, I'm not a chief executive, but I looked at that contract and it looks like something very different from my contract at my current employer. So, but yes, that's the thing. And then Moyo's lawyers also went in to sort of paint Moyo as this as a victim of a reprisal for being a whistleblower.
Yeah.
And then there's certain, if you can prove that, there's certain certain other legal ramifications that come into that. So that's the problem. That's why Old Mutual can't get further. So they want the merits to be heard of them dismissing him.
How does it end? What happens? I mean, do they fight until one of them falls?
Here's my solution. Oh. Peter Moyo definitely cannot work there. He has to leave. He should never have been hired in the first place.
Yeah.
Because of that relationship, precisely the same reason I say Trevor Manuel should not be on the board. Both of them have to be out. The conflict of interest, perceived or real, preclude their participation in the board. Both of them. They should not have been there. Now, Old Mutual has to really step up and appoint the correct people onto that board.
Talking about appointments, Sikonati, you know this. Jabu Mabuza, acting CEO at Eskom and chairman as well, executive chairman, said he would appoint a CEO at Eskom by the end of this month. Is he going to do it?
Well, he has about 5 days left.
Yeah.
Remember, the board has interviewed people. And obviously, what he meant is that we will give the minister a short list of three people, and the minister must make his appointment from there. And that we will do on or before the 30th of September. The interviews have been done. Short lists, I know, have been compiled.
Do we know who the three might be?
It's not yet in the public domain who the three are.
You know who they are. Why don't you tell us?
I'm not telling you, but I am aware some people have been interviewed, quite serious people that really should
One of them put his hand up publicly, didn't he? For the life of me, I'm not going to remember his name.
There's a gentleman by the name of Andy Kalitz.
That's right. He's
a native of Krugersdorp. Yeah. He's been working for BP for the last 20 years. He did confirm that indeed he did apply for the job.
Does he have a real shot?
Look, if it is an appointment based purely on merit and on the ability of the individual to do the job, he's head and shoulders above everybody else. Then in the South African situation, you know there will be matters about black economic empowerment and all of that. That is when it becomes a political decision.
Would they risk, do you think, TJ, making a political appointment out of the one thing that can sink this economy?
Probably, yes. I think.
What a shocking answer.
I mean, I'm not making the decision, but sadly, that's the optics and the politics are very important.
This is quite an interesting conversation. Now, I always maintain, well, what does the CEO need to be hired to do at Eskom? Yeah. I thought that the debt restructuring would be the key thing, but speaking to a couple of financiers, they think the debt restructuring is actually the easy part. The hard part is taking this massive industrial engine, which combines generation and being able to organizationally separate
which is where Khaled's experience in running a complex organization comes in, I suppose.
Absolutely. He started BP's Canada gas business, and now Canada is a net exporter of gas. He's just established BP's gas business in Russia. And he's been out of South Africa, having worked at Eskom at senior levels for 20 years. So he's absolutely
brilliant. Is he ex-Eskom?
Yes, he's ex-Eskom. He left in 1996.
Are there any other former CEOs of Eskom on the shortlist?
Brian Dalmas?
There are, except I'm not at liberty to name names at this point. Yes, there are former senior executives. There may or may not be a former chief executive.
All right, but we don't want to read about them on the Daily Maverick. So, guys, on my phone, there's a story from a source which can't be named on this show, telling me that the South African economy is now in its 70th month of a downward cycle. Is it possible to leave the economic cycle, or are we still subject to it in some way? I mean, 70 months is a very long time. This hasn't happened since the apartheid years. I mean, since the state of emergency, this level of depression in economic activity. I mean, manufacturing, I saw the other day, now accounts for the same portion of economic output as it did in 1968.
Sure. So it's 50
obviously
years.
Obviously, service industries have grown and manufacturing, but you know, there is a real crisis here. Mm. So how do you get out of it? I mean, Stephen Friedman, and I agree with him in today's business day, was arguing you've got to replace the skills that have gone with new ones. You've got to get some immigration going, but the Department of Home Affairs regards this job as to keep people out of the country rather than let them in.
Did you see when Massmart appointed their new CEO, an American from Walmart, they had this little line in the appointment that subject to approval by the Department.
It's quite extraordinary.
Do you follow
this stuff at all, any of you guys? I mean, on immigration and the difficulty of getting skills into this country. Stephen Kosoff says we are 800,000 highly skilled people short in South Africa.
About 24,000-25,000 people have been leaving this country every year up until 2017. Mm. I don't know what has happened since, but my sense is that there's obviously been an increase. Now, people leaving this country don't need anyone's permission to leave.
Sure.
They just leave.
Yeah.
The problem with our Department of Home Affairs, as TJ points out, and indeed the whole setup, is that they regard their job as indeed keeping people out of this country when we desperately need the skills. We're not training our own people to any level as to be able to,
well,
to step
can't
up
be,
to
you
the
can't
table.
Train people unless you've got the skills to train them, and we don't have the skills
even
to train
even in
them.
The educational institutions we are failing to do that. We've dumped everything down and 70 months of downturn, that's 6 years and 6 months.
Yeah.
Let's just get that right. Yeah. For six years and 6 months, we've been going only one way. And the population is increasing at about 2% because, you know, when people are not working, they have to find other things to keep them busy.
One of the reasons, I presume, that Cyril Ramaphosa put Aaron Motsoaledi in Home Affairs was as a reward for backing him in the leadership and keeping him in the cabinet. But surely you could have also said to him, fix the visa thing, fix the immigration. Why would that take? This is something that you don't have to, you know, build up a great big. You just stop doing certain things. And if you go to the airport, Warren, I'm sure you've just come back from overseas. Did you have to go? I mean, what was the queue like at the airport? And how was immigration again? I mean, if you look at some of the stuff on Twitter, it's awful.
I can tell you in the coffee restaurants and the delis in London and Spain that you hear South African accents all over the place. Yeah. I actually think the problem's a lot deeper, Peter. Mm. I think we've got to talk about race in this country and understand what happens, what is expected with BEE and transformation, and why there's this insecurity about letting skills come into the country. Because on the one hand, we've got immigrants flooding the country across the Limpopo River, virtually unchecked. Mm. And on the other, we've got skilled people of all colors getting on planes and leaving for Australia and the United Kingdom.
Refugees crossing the Limpopo River.
Correct.
Refugees, not immigrants. And those are not the people we're talking about here to replace skills. Those are the people we actually need to be keeping out. But yet our borders are just open. You need to be getting people flying in with all of their money to set up business. Make it possible for them to make as much money as possible legally.
As quickly, in the shortest time as possible.
Absolutely.
As well.
That's how you get
but
money.
But provided with one proviso, you create jobs while you're doing it and you know, that's not an unreasonable thing to ask.
That's not an unreasonable thing to ask. And that's how all the major economies are built. Yeah. If you now have 5 million rands, you can go buy a house somewhere in the United States of America and get citizenship. Why can't we do that?
But you've got to create jobs there too. 10 jobs.
Definitely.
For your $1 million or whatever
Definitely.
It might be.
Yeah. Why can't we do that here?
Yeah. No, because we think differently. I mean, we just see it as a threat. And we cannot see the opportunity
in
the mass migration of skills.
And I think we also, I think that one of the things that was very surprising when we had that issue about the journalist that couldn't identify Cyril Ramaphosa in the photo at G20 summit.
Yes.
We kind of think we're bigger than we are. And we're not really. No. We're a mid-sized economy at the bottom of Africa.
But the point is, too, that actually we're still an attractive place to live in, you know. And I mean, there are lots of people living in really grim countries with really good skills and whether anything from, you know, boilermakers to heart surgeons who would rather come and live in Durban or Cape Town or wherever. Then stay where they are, and they might as well forget about it.
Yeah, and they could be taxpayers first. That's the thing. Our tax base is getting eroded. So what you need is more taxpayers on a certain level. And I think Sekinati pointed this out very clearly. Yeah. If you have unskilled labour coming in, they have a very different way of approaching the way they send remittances back. Well, that's why they're here, to send remittances back, to keep people alive back home or educate people at home or whatever. But if it's someone highly skilled or partially skilled, usually that money stays here because they sort of try to build up capital and go to a next level.
Yeah.
So they become taxpayers.
So in an effort to sort of, you know, spin the gloom a little bit, because there's a lot of it around, South Africa placed a Eurobond issue this week that was oversubscribed, and everybody's jolly cheerful about that. It was on the front page today of Business Day. It's a sign of investor confidence in SA. But that also may be not quite the story that should be told, everyone.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news. Yeah. I mean, it's positive that they've bought the bonds, absolutely. Yeah. When you look at the yields, it's quite 3% north of the equivalent US bonds, which are kind of the benchmark.
Yeah.
But just remember that there's about $15 to $16 trillion worth of money that is currently earning a negative yield, meaning if you put 100 euros into an investment, you might only get 99
these are,
or
these 98
These
are bonds
back.
In other countries, in other words, other sovereign bonds.
In largely the developed world. Right. So if you're a German pension fund manager and you're buying German bonds, you get a negative return, not a positive return. Yeah. So there's an enormous appetite, and to take a positive spin on it, there's an enormous appetite to fund things if we want that financing. We've just got to make sure as a country that we can generate positive social and financial returns on those investments.
But if you can invest the funds of German teachers and Singaporean nurses and, you know, Chilean shoemakers in South Africa, why is there a hue and cry about investing the pensions of South African teachers and your my pensions in growing the economy as prescribed assets?
There's completely different. Completely different. The Germans and all of those foreign nationals bringing in their pensions here have got nowhere else to get 4.85% per annum. My money can get 12% on the JSE, 14%, and am not forced to go. So they are not being forced to do this. When you take my pension and invest in Eskom bonds, when you invest in, flush it down South African Airways, you are actually threatening my returns. These foreign savers are bringing in only a fraction of their money, which is looking for homes, a positive return. 4.85% is not even the inflation rate in South Africa.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting, isn't it, when you think about whose savings we live off. And they are Singaporean doctors and Polish nurses and, you know, German road makers or
Japanese
auto workers.
That's
the difference is nobody tells them you will put 10% or 20% of your pension in our bonds.
Yeah.
They've looked everywhere
but they've
got a reasonable certainty that we will pay back and we will give them 4.85%.
What somebody will tell them to do is to pull their money out if we fall into junk status, right?
Just like that. Yeah. Within, like, you just click a few buttons and your money gone.
Yeah.
If my pension is in there, my money is going nowhere else. Yeah. It sinks.
Do you think people are aware of the fact that we live off German workers' pensions or Singaporean or Australian or whoever? It's not really part of our culture to ask where the money comes from.
Absolutely.
But the story is complex.
Yeah, absolutely not. I don't think we appreciate, and still the biggest buyers of our bonds are European pension funds and American pension funds.
Yeah.
You realize when you work in the financial markets how interconnected everything is.
Yeah.
It's often those traditional ties to.
I mean, it seems to me that sometimes there's a small group of people in the Treasury who keep South Africa afloat every day, buying and selling debt, I suppose, in one way or another. We should be grateful to them. There was a disturbing news also today out of the Platinum Belt, Sibanye threatening to let go about 5,000 workers. Why would that be happening, TJ?
They say Marikana is just not profitable. That's the problem. So, that's it in simple terms.
Sibanye bought Lonmans out of the Marikana mine, right?
So, Sibanye historically a gold producer. They were gold fields, a South African asset spun off, what was this, 5, 6, 7 years ago?
Yeah.
And then, did a good job of sort of consolidating their gold business.
Yeah.
And then they sort of started moving into platinum. And a few years ago, I think 2, 3 years ago, they bought this, the biggest platinum producer in the U.S. called Stillwater. Sort of a complex merger, and the whole thing is now called Sibanye Stillwater. And they were looking to expand their reach in platinum, and Lonmin was one of the assets. I can't imagine.
So what's
gone
wrong? Has the price gone south? Is it a question of the economy generally, or the price of platinum?
The platinum price has been negative for quite a while, but there are other PGM, there are other platinum group metals that have made Sibanye itself profitable.
Yeah.
But the workforce at Lonmin is just huge. It's overbloated and Had it not been for this deal, Lonmin would have gone bust.
Sure.
And Lonmin was talking about actually retrenching about 12,000, 15,000 people
at
a go. So this is a third of the jobs that Sibanye can let go immediately.
Yeah. That's an enormous amount of jobs to be lost and of people to be out on the street with families to feed and other commitments to.
And the workforce has already halved.
And the workforce
over
is
the past hard. 5 years at Lonmin, and the tragedy about this whole situation again is, these are people who have absolutely no hope of getting any other job.
This is one of the things, you know, this is why we're hopping on about getting the governance right at Eskom, because the miners have seen their costs increase partly as a result of the higher electricity prices, partly as a result of not just labor, the cost of labor going up, but the productivity of labor declining at the same time.
Yeah.
So you can sustain increases in your pay to workers if your productivity is rising at the same rate. But once this you have not, that divergence where the costs go up and the productivity falls.
Oh, there we go. Reality hits. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week.